Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, it's Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is the founder and president of the Museum of Political Corruption and the Center for Ethical Governance, Bruce Roeder. The Museum of Political Corruption, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan institution, is dedicated to educating and empowering the public by providing a better understanding of political corruption and encouraging solutions that promotes ethics, reform, and honest governance. And the Center for Ethical Governance is the educational and outreach wing of the Museum of Political Corruption, responsible for organizing a lecture series and developing a curriculum on good governance that can be taught in public schools. Founder and President Bruce Craig Roeder, Ph.D., is a professor of music and coordinator of the music department's core curriculum at the College of St. Rose. An ASCAP award-winning composer, Roeder's works have been performed throughout the United States and abroad. Roeder's music is often inspired by American heritage. A longtime resident of Albany, Roeder is also a community activist. You can learn more at www.museumofpoliticalcorruption.org. Professor Roeder, welcome to the Capital Connection.
Hi, Alan. Great to be on with you.
Okay, so my question, if I can, is what's the relationship between your professional PhD in music and political corruption? Can you name political corruptive people who were also composers?
I don't know of any composers who were corrupt, but there is certainly an overlay between what goes on in the arts and what goes on in government. There have been some artists, some composers, even like Shostakovich, for instance, who had to write in a certain way because the government forced him to. So composers and artists frequently get involved with what is going on in the broader world, and I guess I'm one of those composers.
And you know what's so interesting is that on some regular basis, the Trump campaign, for example, has been using as part of its musical background in these convention halls and other places, songs that have been written by people who have great objection to their being used, and so tell the Trump people.
Well, yeah, you know, there is such a thing as copyright, and so you should really try to get permission from the artist before you use one of their songs for one of the public events. And this is yet one more example of how artists are reclaiming their voice, their political voice, by saying, no, you can't use my music for this particular event.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the way it all began. What is the Museum of Political Corruption and why do we need it?
Well, you did a wonderful job introducing it. We are, as you said, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. We were chartered in 2015 by the New York State Board of Regents. And our mission is to educate the public about corruption and empower the public to do something about it. My inspiration for founding this museum goes back to the days of Sheldon Silver and Dean Skelos. But Alan, as you and I know, they had plenty of company. There was an article that came out in the New York Times around that time that said that within the past decade, more than 30 New York public officials were either convicted, sanctioned, or accused of wrongdoing of somehow or another. So New York State has a very rich history of corruption. It's a fascinating history, and it's one that we really need to learn.
Is there actually a museum?
Well, it is in my head right now, and it is in the planning stages. We are going to go virtual first. We were actually looking at a site in downtown Albany because we believe Albany should be the first site for this unique museum, and I don't think there's another one really like it in the world. I have been contacted by other communities around the country saying, hey, we want your museum. And I said, no, we want to build it in Albany first, and then we'll franchise. But in the days of COVID, this doesn't seem to be a particularly good time to open up a bricks-and-mortar facility. So we're doing what a lot of other museums are doing, and that is we are going to start with a virtual museum.
Bruce Roeder, why you? In other words, you're a musician. Obviously, you've done this. You've gotten a lot of people to come on board and look at what you're doing. So why you?
Alan Chartuk, to that, I would say, why not me? It's all of our responsibilities. Yes, I'm a musician. I'm an educator. I'm a composer. But I'm also a citizen, first and foremost. I'm a citizen like most of the listeners out there. And so we all have a responsibility to act. And I go back to what something that Theodore Roosevelt had said, that, you know, we all belong in the arena. And I agree with him on that. And this is how I am participating in the arena of public discourse.
So how corrupt is New York State?
It is corrupt. It ebbs and flows, I suppose, like corruption anywhere. But New York State has had a particularly, as I said, rich history of corruption, most likely because of the sheer amounts of money and influence that flows through the state. It's not that the motivations are any different for New Yorkers than they are anywhere else in the country or the world. It's just the, as I said, the sheer amount of money and power that's involved here.
Can you give us some examples of contemporary political corruption? As you remember, Alphonse D'Amato's famous dictum that was then and this is now. So the real question is it still going on or has it gone underground? We did see, as you said, Sheldon Silver and getting convicted, but not yet going to jail. And that's
Well, look, again, you can go to this article in the Times called The Many Faces of New York Corruption. They've got a whole rogues gallery of folks, William Boylan, Nelson Castro, Mike Cole, Pedro Espada, and the list goes on and on. And these are all fascinating cases. And the last thing we want to do with the Museum of Corruption is demonize anybody. What we're really doing is humanizing this whole subject of corruption. And by doing that, let's learn from it and let's find new and more ethical ways of governing. As you know, not all corruption is necessarily illegal, but it is unethical. And we can be sure to lead in more ethical ways.
If you said to most New Yorkers, do you think New York State government is corrupt? What do you think they'd say?
I would say they probably feel it is. There's been one of the worst things about corruption is the lack of confidence it places in the constituents. And in the history that we've experienced, there has been a lack of confidence. I think it's starting to come back now, and I'm glad about that. But corruption can be cyclical. It fades and it comes back with each subsequent headline. And what we want to do with this museum is we're not about the headlines. Our focus is on a deeper understanding and broader trends. And so we want to make sure that we serve as a permanent resource for the citizens of this state, for the country, and for our leaders, too, to maintain an ethical posture in our government.
You did mention Sheldon Silver. We had that conviction. We have others in which people have gone to jail.
Right.
We saw not that long ago Governor Cuomo, not himself, of course, and Pete Berard went out of his way to say that he was not in any way involved in this, but two of his top and closest aides were and are on their way or in prison already. So what can we deduce from all of that?
We can deduce that corruption is still with us. It's always right there under the surface. I think you're referring to the Buffalo Billion scandal. And as a matter of fact, that's something that we addressed in one of our Nellie Bly Award ceremonies. We gave it last year to Jim Heaney of the Investigative Post for his work on that very story that you're referencing right now, Alan.
Tell us about it. What was that all about? Because, you know, believe me or not, people will have forgotten it already. And it was quite a story.
They will. You were dealing with billions of dollars in development money. And some of that was getting funneled back to certain aides of the governor. It's really quite a classic story of money, of influence peddling and money just being kicked back to certain people for bid rigging, for hiring certain companies to do certain things. And if you want to learn about it, Alan, let's build this museum. Let's make sure there's an exhibit about this so that we can keep stories like this and other stories fresh in people's minds. So you're absolutely right. We don't forget it, and we continue to learn from it.
So what lessons were to be learned from that particular scandal in which two of the governor's top aides were talking about bling and getting the money and all the rest of it?
And the ZD. We can't forget the ZD now. Yes. Well, what can we learn from it? That you shouldn't engage in corruption? That would be easy. I think the bigger lesson to learn is that there's a price to be paid, and if you have a forthright and an aggressive prosecutor who is going to root out corruption, that's to the benefit of all of us. And we certainly appreciate the work that Preet Bharara has done for New York State.
Bruce, how do we stop it? Corruption has been endemic from the very beginning. I'm sure you had corruption, you had prostitution, you had this and that from day one in the caves. How do you stop it?
Alan, I don't think you can ever really stop it. What you can do, and I think the experts will use this word instead, you can control it. It's like having a chronic illness of some sort. You're never going to get rid of it entirely, but you can control it. One of the first ways of controlling it is accepting the problem in the first place, not being in denial that it doesn't exist, because it does. And we all have temptations. We understand that there is greed out there, greed for money, greed for power. And we need to overcome those motivations and work for each other and work for a better society.
In your experience, Bruce, do you think that people would do it because they believe that they will get away with it?
Yes. I don't think they would do it if they didn't believe they would get away with it. Who wants to do it if you know you're going to jail?
There's always the possibility you will get caught and you will go to jail. It's always extraordinary to me, the arrogance of some of the people who do this stuff.
Yeah, it is. And I think in this regard, you're probably right. There are some people who have that arrogance, who have that hubris, who think, I'll never get caught. Well, I suppose if enough people start getting caught, then maybe they will change their attitudes and hopefully we can start catching more people. And it's not just those at the top of the list. Also, you know, corruption occurs at many different levels, and we need to understand it even at its smallest level. Corruption occurs societally too, if we're going to talk about corruption in terms of the racial injustice that we're seeing right now. George Floyd's murder was not only tragic in and of itself, but it was a metaphor for all who are marginalized and can't breathe. What does that mean in terms of corruption? It's not what we usually think of as corruption, with kickbacks and bribery and self-dealing, but racism, which is a form of power dynamic, is a form of societal corruption. So this is a time for soul searching and reflection for all of us, individuals and institutions alike. So on so many different levels, we need to deal with the motivations that cause pain and injustice within our society.
What legislation would you like to see the state legislature pass that would, you know, hinder corruption in the future?
An excellent question. Look, I believe they've tried to make strides with election reform. I know there's a ton of money that goes into elections, and quite often money has a stronger voice than you or I do. And that's not at all fair. I know that we have various watchdog organizations that look out for our interests or are looking at our politicians to ensure or try to ensure that they work ethically. Whether or not you can legislate your way out of all corruption is probably not going to happen.
And of course, you will have to want to, Bruce, you have to want to. You know, here's a bunch of people who sit in the two houses of the state legislature who have to be looking over their shoulder and say, if I make a mistake or if somebody says something about me. So why vote for something that would really be ironclad and could cause them a great deal of trouble?
Well, I agree. And it's not going to happen. Look, I think I'm sure that most public servants go to Albany with the right intentions, and they face various cultural pressures, which might lead you into other directions. And I think that's the sort of level that we need to address this. Yes, of course, laws can be helpful, but they're not the be-all and end-all of all of this. As a matter of fact, just bring this back to the museum again. When we open up the virtual museum, because we believe that that government works best when we all participate, we're going to have immersive and interactive exhibits. So, for example, Alan, let's role play. You go onto our virtual museum and you enter one of our virtual museum exhibits and take on the persona of a freshman legislator. Maybe you meet with a lobbyist who wants something from you. You meet with a wealthy donor, a constituent who's asking for a questionable land variance. A relative comes knocking at your door wanting a job in the regional office. Or at the end of the day, your party leader says she'll give you a plum committee assignment if you do her a favor of some sort. So these are the sort of ethical challenges we want to pose to our museum visitors to see what they will do. And this is the sort of education that we have to begin in our community and with the public to make sure they have these sort of dialogues with their elected officials. And this is the sort of cultural change we seek with the Museum of Political Corruption.
Of course, there are all kinds of political corruption. I knew a young assemblyman years ago. He was a married man. He got involved with a woman, and he had to quit over this. He got caught. Would you consider that kind of behavior stepping out to be corrupt?
Personally, no, Alan. I'm not that naive. I don't think the private lives to that extent of our politicians are involved. It wasn't illegal. Yes, it wasn't ethical. But did it involve some sort of a power dynamic that abused his office for his constituents or her constituents?
Well, let me interrupt you and say, okay, I'll add another layer onto this. His co-respondent here was a lobbyist.
Oh, what do we say about strange bedfellows? Well, in that case, it could very well be. If that was the relationship that was meant to be, good. Let them resign their positions and go off and be in love, which is fine.
But that's not what happened. They didn't go off in love, and the wife found out about it, and she said, come home. You're done. She became the sheriff. You know, I wonder a lot about whether this thing, Bruce Schroeder, can ever go on to places where the sheriffs or the FBI overexerts its power. The one I remember the most, of course, was Abscam, which the FBI posed as an Arab sheik and got people to come in and offered them money. And a lot of people, and very important people, went to jail as a result of that.
Right.
But don't you think that was a little excessive that you would tempt somebody? And by the way, there was such hell to pay about that it's never happened again since that time. But meantime, a lot of people went to jail. You think that's excessive?
I remember that. That was quite a scandal at the time. I would have to think about it if it was excessive or not. Look, we want to hold our leaders to a high ethical standard. Do we want to entrap them? That's a whole different level right now, and I think there are serious questions that need to be addressed about that. I do agree with you, Alan.
When people, you've made reference to this, but when people give you $1 million for a campaign, it's against the law to say, if I give this to you, will you give me something back? That's against the law. But how naive can you be that somebody gives you $1 million, they're not going to want something back for that?
No, of course. And as a matter of fact, I was just reading through Jane Mayer's book, Dark Money, and as you know, we're honoring her with this year's Nellie Bly Award. But there's a quote in there from former Kansas Senator Bob Dole, who says, if somebody gives you a lot of money, whether they say it or not, you know they want something from you. And you can't be naive. Absolutely not.
They may say, well, yeah, I gave them a lot of money because I want good, clean government. Hey, you got to prove it in this case.
Right.
In the case of Shelley Silver, they found somebody he had given a grant to, but he had said to him, now send me some clients, basically, as I understand it. And that went over that line. So there's a careful line, but I think an awful lot of people in the state legislature must have been a little bit afraid when they went to sleep at night and had a few nightmares about that one, because it's fairly common.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure they were rattled. And this, again, just goes to show what the infusion of money, the relationship between money and politics, and how you have to be so careful with that. But we want our leaders to be compensated for what they do in serving their constituents. But at the same time, money has a corrupting influence also. And we need to be constantly on guard for that. As a matter of fact, in our museum, we're even planning a Follow the Money self-guided tour. Maybe when we have a physical museum, we'll have like dollar bills on the floor or something where you can just follow the money and go from one exhibit to the other. So there's very little getting away from the influence of big money in politics.
So, Bruce Broder, where do the lobbyists come in? Lobbyists approach the legislature and they say, we'd like you to vote for this bill. But it's no secret that the organizations that they work for, sometimes not the lobbyists, but another entity within that organization, follow up with giving their friends money and their political enemies don't get the money, but their opponents do. So tell us about lobbyists. Is that a potentially corruptive part of the government?
Potentially. I will tell you, I read a couple of years ago Zephyr Teachout's wonderful book, Corruption in America, where it details this very gray area with lobbyists. Sometimes states have banned lobbying, claiming it was illegal. Other times they haven't. It's a very difficult subject. We want people who can effectively advocate for our positions, but at the same time, we don't want such a cozy relationship, especially if gifts or favors become part of the transaction. So we're thinking of a lobby of lobbyists in our museum. We want to explore this subject. It's not black and white. And so much of corruption is not black and white. But we need to understand it better. And that also goes with lobbyists as well.
Now, do you induct people who are famous corruptive influences in the government? For example, we see somebody I used to call the bad Kruger, Carl Kruger, this Kruger who I consider the good Kruger. And he got caught, you know, in the same way that the Baseball Hall of Fame inducts people. Do you induct people too?
Well, we plan on it. Look, people have been clamoring for us to have a Hall of Shame, and we're also going to have a Hall of Fame where we honor good people. We're not just about, you know, the bad guys. We're about honoring the good people as well. But this is something we're toying with, and it's just something I sent out to my trustees. How do we select? Who would merit inclusion in our Hall of Shame? Does there have to be an indictment? Does there have to be some degree of historical perspective? I like your comparison with Cooperstown because, you know, maybe we should wait a few years, and I could see a corrupt politician being disappointed if they didn't get nominated on the first ballot. But, you know, we will want to highlight not just the individual, but their stories to make sure that there are lessons learned.
Well, you know, Bruce, there is such a wide range of corruptive influences in government. People give millions of dollars, as we have talked about, and they expect something back for it all too often. And they get something back. They just can't be caught on tape saying, if you do this, I'll do this. So one wonders whether there is a way to put limitations on this. And we only have a few minutes, but maybe you could go into some of the ways in which we could stop political corruption.
Education. I believe education is step one. If we can educate the public to recognize corruption, that's the first stage in addressing it.
Well, let me stop you right there. Everybody you ask, you know, I've taught about the state legislature for years and years. I've given a lot of speeches. Always a hand goes up and says, come on, they all do it. They're all corrupt. What do you think of the state legislature to say to the man on the street, they're all a bunch of bums, they're corrupt? So it isn't as if you have to educate, because people have start on the premise that there is corruption there, and there probably is. So what do you say to that?
I say there's a general sense of corruption. There's a vague understanding of it. But I think we need to enhance people's understanding of what really is and what isn't corrupt. Look, I myself am an optimist. I do believe in government. This whole project for the museum hasn't made me jaded or cynical. I believe in government. I believe government can work for the people. And I want to make sure that we all believe that as well. But we have to have faith in our leaders. And sometimes corruption is more about unethical behavior rather than illegal behavior. And we need to understand that as well. Before we go, Alan, I just want to make sure all of your listeners are invited to our upcoming Nellie Bly event. Can I talk about it for a moment?
Of course. I was just about to do that. Go ahead.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, this is the fourth annual award we're giving out for the Nellie Bly Award for Investigative Reporting. It's going to be on September 24th. We usually do this ceremony live, but this year it's going to be on Zoom. So all of your listeners are invited. No one has an excuse for missing it. We are going to be celebrating the amazing Jane Mayer, from the New Yorker Magazine, author of the book Dark Money. The event is going to be emceed by Joe Donahue, and folks can register for this free event on our website, www.museumofpoliticalcorruption.org.
One only wonders why, in addition to giving out an award to the people who are exposing corruption, you don't give one out every year to somebody who is corrupt. But maybe that would be my preference. Okay, so anyway, we're out of time. Our guest has been Bruce Roeder, president and founder of the Museum of Political Corruption. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Alan. It's been great talking with you.